Yes, four.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the committee to order. A quorum is present, and the first order of business, before we forget, move on to everything else, is to approve four sets of minutes.
Madam
and,
Chair?
Representative
Madam
Benson. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I do have a question about the minutes from March 7th.
Okay. What would that be? Well, let's move them first. So, Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes of March 7th, March 12th, March 11th, and March 14th.
Okay. So, the minutes are moved. Representative Albright, what do you note here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the schedule on the front page in terms of for members present, members excused. And then I look to the back, and I see, given the fact that I did call for a roll call vote that day on 2806, and I note a discrepancy in terms of the members excused on the front and the members excused on the back, and principally both Grünhagen and Morgan. And now I understand Representative Grünhagen excused himself, and I did review the tape, and so I heard his voice. But when it goes to the roll call, I don't recognize anyone asserting either an absent or excuse for Representative Morgan.
Yeah. Well, I think Representative Albright, if the member is present, is here on the committee, but he isn't present in the room when there's a roll call, often it just is not recorded. His vote is not recorded. Is that kind of responsive to what you're saying here?
I'm just wondering, Representative Grünhagen asked for an excused absence. He had an appointment or a meeting that day, but I don't recall ever hearing Representative Morgan asking for an excusal from the roll call.
Right. Well, Representative Albright, I think that it's common practice in our, and I think, I'm not sure what the rules say formally about it, but the practice of the committee when we don't necessarily indicate if somebody is formally excused. I mean, as you know, members are in and out of the room all the time while simultaneous votes are taking place often, and it's pretty common for a member to simply miss a vote, whether it's a roll call or a voice vote. And so I would be more concerned if you were saying that somebody voted who wasn't officially here. I thought that was what you were going to say initially. But I don't think it's a problem that his name isn't mentioned on here. It would be a problem if he was mentioned and he was excused.
Yeah, I just note from listening to the tape that he was the lone exception to being excused when the roll was called.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, the committee administrator will, or the committee legislative assistant will check on that.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing it
I
to our attention.
That.
So let's, maybe what we'll do then is, if we could modify the motion, Representative Benson, is not approve the minutes of March 7th right now, and we'll wait on those until we get
Thank
confirmation.
You, Madam Chair. Appreciate that.
So Representative Benson has moved the minutes of March 11th, March 12th, and March 14th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. I hope that we can, since that's our, should be our only vote for today, I guess we can't get any more controversial than that. At least on votes. Okay. So members, the order of business for today, first of all, is a walkthrough of our omnibus bill, which is House File 2402, and the delete all amendment, which is in your packets. And so we're going to ask our staff to walk us through the bill. And I would just say that in terms of questions, if you have clarifying questions while we do the walkthrough, I think it would be appropriate to ask them. But in terms of the content, since we're asking our research staff to do the walkthrough, any debate on what's in or out should wait. And so the rest of the order of business today is to take testimony on the bill. And then, of course, when we come back on Friday, we'll be debating, marking it up, debating amendments and what have you. So, with that, who's going to start the walkthrough? Ms. Aves, please.
Madam Chair and members, I'm
Danielle Pinelli and I are going to go through Article 1 rather quickly for you. Sections 1 and 2, 4 and 5, 8 to 18 of this article are from House File 3027, which is the DHS Child and Family Policy Bill. It contains provisions modifying North Star care for children.
Madam Chair, Article 1, Sections 3 and 7 came from House File 1987 related to MFIP and General Assistance Drug Screening. Section 6 is from House File 2449. It relates to GRH contracts.
Madam Chair and members, Sections 19 to 21 are from House File 1966 regarding smoke-free foster care. Section 22 is from House File 1106, the Safe Passage Bill. Section 23...
Madam Chair and members, Section 23 of Article 1 comes from House File 2932. It establishes a TANF task force.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to Article 2, Sections 1, 3, and 10 to 12 come from House File 2307 relating to drug and alcohol overdose prevention. And Article 2, Section 2 comes from House File 2581, which is licensed dentists administering influenza vaccinations.
And Madam Chair, Sections 4 to 8 are from House File 1872. These provisions regulate the pharmacy benefit manager contracts. Then Section 9 and Section 13 of the article relate to the prescription monitoring program from House File 2527.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to Article 3, the Chemical and Mental Health Services article. Section 1 relates to adult foster care training requirements, and that's from House File 2169. Sections 2 and 8 are the DHS direct care and treatment provisions related to neuroleptic medication and their pilot project. Sections 3 to 4 and Section 7 are from House File 2470, DHS Advisory Committee sunset extensions, and Sections 5 and 6 are provisions from House File 2410 on DHS culturally specific treatment in chemical dependency programs. Article 4 is the health-related licensing boards. This article contains provisions on all of the bills we heard a week ago today. Sections 1 to 4 are related to chiropractors. Sections 5 to 8, occupational therapists. Sections 9 to 17, athletic trainers, 18, doulas, 19 and 20, licensed professional clinical counselors, 21 to 32, dental professionals and dentists, 33 to 37, podiatrists, sections 38 to 46 and 48 are related to the health professional services programs. Section 47 is from House File 1604 about required reporting of diverted narcotics or controlled substances. And Section 49, Paragraph B, instructs the reviser to correct references to the term physician assistant. Article 5 is the Board of Pharmacy article, and that contains House File 2545, the Board of Pharmacy Policy Bill in its entirety.
And Madam Chair, Article 6 deals with the Health Department and Public Health. Sections 1 to 4 are from House File 2656. They modify the use of the all-payer claims database and suspend the provider peer grouping system.
Madam Chair, Sections 5 and 16 come from House File 2944 relating to the diagnostic imaging requirement exemption. Sections 6 through 12, Section 37, and Section 38A are from House File 2526, modifying the newborn screening program. Sections 13 and 31 through 35 are from House File 1931, relating to e-cigarette regulation. Sections 14 and 15 come from House File 2005, which is the Comprehensive and Primary Stroke Center Criteria Modification. Sections 17 to 20 are from House File 2977, relating to home care provider licensing. Sections 21 to 23 and Section 36 are from House File 2437, relating to dementia training requirements. Section 24 is from House File 2248, relating to the Safe Harbor Program. Section 25 is from House File 2361, Health Disparities for Minority Populations. Section 26 is from House File 2306, relating to the scope of preparation and embalming room requirement for funeral establishments. Sections 27 to 29 and Section 38, Paragraph B, from House File 2177 for tanning bed regulation for use by minors. And Section 30 is from House File 1971 for AED registration. Article 7 is relating to local public health, and Sections 1 through 29 are made up of House File 2523 relating to local public health system changes.
Madam Chair and members, Article 8 is the continuing care article. Sections 1 to 13 contain various continuing care policy provisions from the DHS continuing care policy bill, which was House File 2649. And Sections 14 and 15 of Article 8 come from House File 2282, the Autism Statewide Strategic Plan Implementation and Task Force Repeal.
And Madam Chair, Article 9 is the health care article. Sections 1 and 5 are from House File 2023, dealing with home care nursing services. Section 2 is from House File 2760. This sets up a healthcare homes advisory committee. Section 3 is new language not from a House file. This is language requiring statewide procurement for DHS managed care and managed care under Minnesota Care. Section 4 is from House File 1347. This deals with durable medical equipment and basic care and provides a definition of basic care.
Madam Chair and members, the last article in the omnibus bill is Article 10, the miscellaneous article. It contains sections 1 to 12, which come from House File 2916, the DHS operations policy bill.
All right. Thank you very much. And members, if you're at all like me, that was a pretty quick run through and not all that easy to follow all the time. Not any criticism to our wonderful staff, but just because there's a lot here and it's a very quick overview. And I know that you're going to have some questions about things that are in and things that are out. I just want to explain to part of our process this year, and because of our short timelines, we have been working, Mr. Bergeron in particular, has been working very diligently to make sure that everything that needed to make a stop in another committee made that stop, or in some cases is still making those stops. So there are sections of language from some of our bills that, for instance, had to be vetted in civil law or government operations, and we're so everything that's in here has not necessarily been cleared as of this moment. But if it hasn't been cleared or if changes are made in other committees by Friday when we do our markup, we will take those sections out or change them to line up with what those committees did. So things are just a little bit still moving here. Most of it is not, but there may be things that are still in flux in that respect. And then the other thing that I think most of you probably know and understand is that because this is a policy bill, it can't carry fiscal items in it. So our understanding and attempt here is that whatever is in this bill, and certainly whatever comes out of this committee on Friday, will have to be fiscally neutral. Otherwise, it can't be riding in this bill. So just so everybody's clear on that. So are there clarifying questions from the committee at this point? Before we go to testimony, Representative Lohmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at Article 9, third from the bottom, new language, the statewide procurement. Doesn't really have an author. I'm just kind of curious what that is. Where did this come from? Did we ever hear it in committee? What is
right.
this?
Oh, thank you for raising that issue, Representative Lohmer, and I meant to explain this as well. There are things in here that have not had a formal hearing in the committee, and this, what we're doing by putting, and there are other things in here as well, for example, the Alzheimer's training language didn't get in soon enough to have a formal hearing in the committee, and so what we're doing with that language you mentioned and a couple other pieces is that what we're doing today by hearing testimony, we're having the hearing. There will be testimony on those pieces. And then, you know, as you know, Friday is the markup of the bill. So this gives members a chance to know what that is, think about it, if you want to amend it out, if you have concerns based on the testimony, just as though we'd had a bill hearing Tuesday, yesterday, or the day before. So there are some things that are here that you haven't had a chance to hear before, but you're going to hear them today. So that language comes from DHS. I put it in there, and you're going to hear testimony from DHS on that and from the health plans on that language. So that came from me just to clear up any mystery. I think that's the one piece that didn't have a bill number, but this is, I can't say that this is exactly a process that we've been through before, but this process of not everything that you see in an omnibus bill had a full hearing. Sometimes I think Representative Abler is kind of the master of adding things even on the floor, which we certainly don't intend to do. This is our process of allowing the committee to hear and understand all the language that's in the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abel.
Sorry, I'm late. You know, there's some things upon which the entire body needs to weigh in, I believe, at times, so we want to give them that opportunity, right?
Right, Representative Abler. Hopefully we get a chance to let the committee that understands these issues perhaps a bit better than the entire body weigh in first, but that's certainly what we're doing here at Representative Lohmer. So there is, you know, I am certainly not trying to skip the process in any respect, because this is the committee is going to have a full opportunity to hear and understand, and hopefully, you know, if there's debate to be had, to have it on these issues in this process. So with that, I think, are there other questions for members? Okay, seeing none, we're going to move to testimony, and we have two testifiers from DHS, John Sellen and Jane Lawrence. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Sellen. I'm a Human Services Area Manager at Hennepin County, and I'm at the Department of Human Services. I'm the project lead for North Star Care for Children. I'm speaking on the provisions in Article 1 from the DHS Children and Families Policy Bill that pertain to North Star Care for Children. These are a series of technical corrections. There are a number of North Star Care for Children from last session passed. It will be effective January 1st of 2015. And it unifies benefits for children in foster care, in relative care, and in adoptive care. And in doing so, will eliminate a major barrier that has interfered with children in foster care who can't be returned home from acquiring permanent families. Most of the corrections bring North Star Care into compliance with federal Title IV regulations, specifically adding federally required background study requirements for North Star Care foster care. This reflects current foster care practice for county, tribal, and private agencies, and this is in Section 10.
And Mr. Sellen, could you, I don't know if you have our bill in front of you, can you give us a page number? Or maybe staff can give us a page number so members can be looking at the language you're discussing.
Madam Chair, the language he's referring to is in Article 1, the Children and Families article, and it's split between sections 4 and 5 and 8 to 18.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Aves. So 4 and 5. So if I'm looking at this right, that's on pages 5 to 7 of the bill. And what was the second part, Ms. Aves?
8 to 18, Madam Chair.
So section 8 to 18. So section 8 starts on page 10. Thank you, Representative Ward. Okay, I'm sorry. Please proceed.
Certainly, Madam Chair. It would also include section 24 at the very end. The background study section is on page 11, section 10. The rest of the corrections streamline processes, reduce duplication, add legal references or clarifying language inclusive of tribal practices. There are four changes here. The clarifying eligibility to be inclusive of tribal and county agency practices. This is in sections 8, 9, 11, and 12. Secondly, it streamlines the uniform assessment process and the reimbursement process for relative custody assistance to make them more efficient. This occurs in sections 13, 14, and 15. I will note that as a result of discussions with stakeholders in the last couple of days, we'll be seeking some slight modifications in the reassessment process.
Okay, and we have a question from Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at line 12.33 where it talks about the North Star program. And my one question is, it looks like it's changing, you know, eligible for adoption assistance when the criteria in paragraph A is met. And so I'm just wondering, will this have a fiscal impact if certain new language in here is allowing new eligibility? I'm just wondering about if there's a fiscal impact or cost that DHS will incur because of that.
Mr. Sellin.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that's a good question, but no, there is no fiscal impact. What this does is this is meeting a federal requirement that if a child is in kinship assistance, which is the assistance package for children whose custody has been transferred to a relative, that we have to have a door for them to move on to adoption assistance. You may remember that one of the things that North Star Care for Children does is it unifies the benefits among the three. And so if they're already receiving benefits under kinship assistance, there would be no additional cost to their moving on to adoption assistance. The benefit simply follows them with the change in legal status.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
It adds a series of legal cross-references, tidying things up so that North Star Care for Children, Chapter 256N, is referred to elsewhere in statute. This occurs in Sections 1, 2, 16, and 17. And finally, it changes one of the components' names from guardianship assistance to kinship assistance. We've noticed in working with stakeholders that the term guardianship is used in a variety of ways in Minnesota law, and that referring to the benefit package for children who are being cared for by relative custodians and not guardians at all, calling that guardianship assistance, even though that's the federal term, has actually been confusing. So we're changing that to kinship assistance.
Okay. All right. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Questions? Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I missed something, but when did this go through the early childhood and Youth Development Committee?
Mr. Sellin?
Madam Chair, Representative, I know at one point that was considered, and then at a subsequent point we were told we didn't need to appear in front of that committee.
Who told you you didn't have to appear? Because I remember telling the department last year when the bill came in that it did have to go to our committee. And so for somebody to just on their own decide that I don't know any way that this doesn't belong in the committee. We reviewed it last year. It came in very late to directly to Representative Huntley's committee, which was improper in the first place because it was full of policy in it immediately, and Representative Huntley didn't want to deal with all of it at that point, needless to say. We did carve out certain parts, and we got them through for the department last year. We had special hearings after everything was over, and I told them that when they did it this year, it had to come through our committee. So unless you want to take that out, this bill has to go to our committee.
Yeah. Representative Mullery, I think this is something that we should probably talk about offline, and if, you know, if this doesn't, you know, if there's a decision that this should have, didn't make all of its stops, and there's no opportunity for it to do that, we can always remove it from the bill. So let's continue to talk about it. Appreciate your raising your concerns. Any other questions? Okay, not seeing any, so thank you very much. And then the other testifier, Ms. Lorenz, did you want to add something?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jane Lorenz with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm going to be talking about a couple of sections of the bill, Article 1, Section 4, and Article 1, Section 5. So the first one is Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Supplement Racial Repeal. That's Article 1, Section 4. Some background on this. Minnesota Supplemental Aid is a state income supplement for people who receive or are eligible for federal supplemental security income benefits through the Social Security Administration. Special needs payments can be authorized for some housing costs in certain situations. This section strikes language that limits the number of people receiving Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance, it used to be called Shelter Needy, to no more than 25% of the people living in a building. Eliminating the racial restriction provides greater housing opportunities for people leaving institutions, nursing facilities, or homelessness, and it's consistent with Minnesota's Olmstead Plan and Minnesota's plan to prevent end homelessness. This provides people with disabilities more choice on where and with whom they live, and it reduces the administrative burden on counties in determining eligibility for Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance. The next section, which is section...
Could I just stop you there? Because sure. I think this does raise some questions. Okay. And could you just explain the difference between this and the... This committee just heard a bill and went through a big process around a question about having exceptions to the 25% cap on people with disabilities living in one facility. And so because this sounds like that, I wonder if you could kind of just explain the difference with what we're doing here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's two parts to that. One is for housing, which is what this one is for, the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance. The other one is for home and community-based services, which is the waiver program out of the department. So this one we're talking about here has to do with the housing assistance for people with disabilities who receive Minnesota Supplemental Aid. So it's two separate programs.
Okay. Any questions on that, members? Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get my head around it. So I don't know, Madam Chair, if you remember the number of the bill that we just heard. Was it yesterday on this? 1992. Does what we heard yesterday and this kind of dovetail, kind of both of them need to happen together to kind of lift that 25% cap? Because I don't know if we've heard this separately. I was trying to look if we heard this separately in a bill or if this dovetails with that or how that works.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, yeah. These are two separate programs, and at times there may be overlap, but they are separate.
Okay, and I wonder, can one of our staff address this? Who would be the right person? Ms. Pugnelli, can know if any of them could kind of give us any more information. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think one explanation is that these funds serve a much broader population. As she mentioned, it's homeless people, it's transitional housing. It doesn't necessarily have to be people with disabilities. In the same way that we were discussing them yesterday, I think that's part of it. My question was going to be that I understand that the Department of Human Services is undertaking a major look at this program because it is one of our fastest growing programs, and there's some real inconsistencies in terms of how it's being used and the program outcomes expectations. And so my question would be, why would we change this, or how does this change influence your ability to do the reform work that I understand you're involving a lot of people in the discussion of?
Ms. Lorenz?
Madam Chair, Representative, we are actually undergoing some reform efforts with GRH, which is actually the program I think you're referring to that's growing really quickly. Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance is actually very underutilized. We only have about 600 people in the state using that right now. It is for people who have disabilities and are on supplemental security income through the Social Security Administration. You have to qualify several different ways to be able to access this assistance right now. But it is part of some of our reform efforts we're looking at going forward in the future.
Other questions for members?
Right. Representative Mack?
Last question. And maybe, was this, just for clarification, was this in a bill that we heard? And I was just trying to remember. I thought I had a note that this was maybe in a Representative Allen's bill, House File 3027, but I wasn't quite sure and wondered if Representative Allen knew if this was something that she had carried in a bill of hers. It is. Okay, so it was in the Representative Allen bill then. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any further questions? Okay. All right, not seeing any. So thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Deb Holtz? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Holtz, and I represent the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. We are an office that I think most of you are familiar with. We're mandated by federal law and supported by some state law to ensure the people receiving, any adults receiving long-term care in Minnesota are protected. I'm going to actually turn it over to Heidi Holstein, who is with the Long-Term Care Imperative, to talk about the technical parts of the bill. And then I will answer some questions.
Okay, and thank you. And before we do that, let's just tell the committee what we're talking about here.
I'm sorry.
Because we're looking at a 200-page bill, and I think they need to know what we're addressing here. And it's the Alzheimer's dementia training piece of the bill. And do you know what page that piece is on so that we can be looking at the language?
Madam Chair, I apologize. It's Article 6, and it is on page 139.
Okay, and just so members understand, this is there are just a few pieces that didn't come through in separate bill form. This is one of them, and the reason is that this is a result of a compromise that has been worked on very long and hard by a number of parties, and they just couldn't get it done in time to have the posting and the proper notice and get the bill heard in the regular turn of events here. So that's why they're here today, and you're going to hear about this section, and hopefully everything here is going to be something that is agreed to and won't be controversial. So with that, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Heidi Holstein, Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota, and I also represent the Long-Term Care Imperative, which includes Aging Services of Minnesota. And as you said, Madam Chair, this has been a long process. We started talking a few months ago with the Alzheimer's Association, and we finally did come to a final agreement on Friday afternoon. And so we worked over the weekend to get the final language together, and here we are today with a final agreement. So the agreement is between the Alzheimer's Association, the Long-Term Care Imperative, the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, and the Minnesota Home Care Association. And we thank all of you for your patience and for your push to get this agreement completed. We all support it. It's a very good first step for seniors in Minnesota, and the providers also support this. So I will walk through the sections, and specifically we are referring to section Article 6, sections 21, 22, 23, and 36. So I will go through the summary and be open for questions afterwards, or whatever, however you choose. So for housing with service providers that have a special program or a specialized unit for persons with Alzheimer's disease or other dementias, or promotes the establishment as providing services for persons with Alzheimer's or other dementia, the establishment must train its employees on topics related to dementia as follows. Supervisors of direct care staff must have 8 hours of training within the first 120 hours of work. Non-supervisory direct care staff must have 8 hours of training within their first 160 hours of work. Housing managers of these settings must have 8 hours of training within their first 160 hours of work. Staff that do not provide direct care must have 4 hours of training within their first 180 hours of work. And new employees may satisfy these requirements, providing written proof that they have had this training previously. All employees will need 2 hours of continuing training every 12 months after their employment. For assisted living providers that do not advertise or have a specialized designation that they provide services for persons with Alzheimer's or dementia-related conditions, supervisors of direct care staff must have 4 hours of training within 120 days. Housing managers of these settings must have 4 hours of training within 120 days of beginning work. Non-supervisory direct care staff and staff that do not provide direct care, such as maintenance or housekeeping, must have 4 hours of training within their first 160 hours of work. And again, new employees can satisfy that they've done this within 18 months. And then all employees will need 2 hours of continuing education every 12 months. So that is one section. There is a section that discusses housing manager training. Currently, housing managers do not have continuing education requirements, and we are proposing that over 2 years, every housing manager would have 30 hours of continuing education. Another section in this bill has to do with emergency planning. We hear from most of our providers that they already have these plans. However, we think it's important to put this in statute that every provider would have an emergency plan that they work with their local law enforcement to put together and occasionally review that with them. The final section of this bill has to do with evaluation of dementia training, and the Department of Health will be looking at this, and they'll be discussing whether or not additional settings or provider types should apply to those, as well as cost implications for groups or individuals on the training if this is to be expanded. And then the enforceability of training requirements is also included in that study. The implementation date is January 1st of 2016. However, the study is due prior to that implementation.
Thank you. Questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know when we've talked about this in the past, it's always, you know, been about the needs of the tenants and making sure when people have behavioral issues or other things that people know how to respond appropriately. So I'm kind of surprised on line 141.3 that we're allowing continuing ed for a real estate license to count towards the manager's training. And I know that we have had a variety of people go into offering these kinds of living services, but to me, a realtor's license training isn't really what this program was oriented towards in terms of all the other things are appropriate training related to a nursing home administrator license, nursing license, social worker license, and other, you know, but real estate training to me is not what the goal is here. And could you tell us a little bit about what the discussion was on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I have to admit that we had put this bill together last year as the imperative. Ms. Thurlow may answer that, but I would like to add that within this 30 hours of training, we do have a requirement that 8 hours has to be specific to dementia training. And today, these folks don't have to have any training. So Ms. Thurlow may have more recollection than I do.
Right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, the section that you're referring
to...
You
need to give your name, sorry.
For
We all know you, but you need to give your name.
Forgive me, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota and also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, the section for which you're referring to has to do with a broader goal that we have to do with training the managers of housing with services establishments. And as Ms. Holstey indicated, a portion of that continuing education has to do with dementia training. And as you'll see, a portion of those 30 hours must be related to dementia, topics related to dementia as specified in law. The remaining training really has to do with the role that housing managers play in housing with services settings. As the committee is aware, housing with services is separate between the management of the property itself and the provision of direct care services. In some cases, it's very appropriate to have real estate training as part of that that role as housing manager, because they really are functioning as a property manager and not really overseeing the direct care provision of direct care. And so in those instances, we did think it was appropriate to include real estate to meet their real estate credits as a portion of that overall 30 hours. But again, all of those housing managers would also have to meet some dementia training requirements as specified in that section.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on this because I don't think as it's written it limits what portion would be the real estate training. And quite honestly, my experience has been that sometimes the ones where it's an apartment manager thinks this is a new clientele, they do less well in serving a population with frailty and needs than some of the people who have some of the other licenses that are mentioned here. So I just want to make sure that the intent of this is fulfilled as we move forward.
Yeah,
thank you.
And thank you, Representative Loeffler. And let me just say again, members, that this what you see before you, no one thinks it's the be-all and end-all, but it is the product of an intense negotiation between parties, some of whom wanted much more of a requirement and some of whom probably wanted a lot less. So I don't know how fragile the agreement may be, but I'm a little concerned that it might be kind of fragile. And if we want to do anything this year, it was kind of, not to discourage you, Representative Loeffler, I think if you can talk offline with some of the parties, but I just kind of want members to know that this is an intensely pressured piece of work to get something done this year. Ms. Holt.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, you raise excellent points, and it's part of the broader issue in looking at services that people get in housing with services settings where they might get assisted living services, because we have this wonderful unique law in Minnesota, but as you and I have discussed many times, there's also a separateness. We've got the housing portion of it where people do have to have housing managers. They have to know landlord-tenant law. That's a big part of the challenges that come to our office. But then they also have to have the direct services licensed by the home care and the Department of Health. I am so excited about this bill because this represents, and it took all till this Friday, Saturday, much with Representative Liebling's help, for providers who came forward with their own initiative to say, yes, we need more training, we need more support. There's a lot of people with really complex behavioral needs, and advocates who came all the way saying, everybody needs everything. And this is an enormous, just amazing, wonderful bill that pulls it all together. Everybody's in support of it. It's a consensus bill. So if we could move forward with it, I would be happy to head up the concerns that you're talking about, because you are exactly correct. There are challenges in these settings. We don't compare to anything else across the country. We have very unique assisted living services, and that's a good thing, but it presents this unique way of licensing and supervising and protecting consumers. So I thank you for your comments. They are very relevant.
Thank you, Ms. Holtz. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you mentioned at the outset that everything in this bill has to be cost neutral. So I'm just curious, you know, there's a lot of
training that's going on here. Who's actually paying for all of this training?
Ms. Halsey?
Madam Chair and Representative Lohmer, the provider would pay for the training for their employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Lohmer? Okay. Other questions from members? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. And
thank you so much for your
hard work.
Thank you.
Jim Golden? And Commissioner Jess. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and with me today is Medicaid Director Jim Golden.
And members, we're going to now discuss the language that is on page 186. So starting on page 186 and I think just going over to 187. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to provide kind of our rationale for why we think this is important. Then Mr. Golden's going to walk through more of kind of the line-by-line review of this. Let me just say, start by saying that less than 2 weeks ago, we received a final rules from CMS that talked about kind of rules for getting basic health plan funding that will fund a lot of our Minnesota Care program going into the future. As part of those final rules, it made it very clear that to get that funding, we must re-procure for our Minnesota Care program our managed care contracts in Minnesota Care statewide. So we must do statewide re-procurement for Minnesota Care next year. At the department, we think it is also wise, at the same time we're doing statewide re-procurement for Minnesota Care, to also put our PMAP managed care contracts out on a statewide basis as well. There has been a lot of changes, as all of you know, certainly in the marketplace this last year, a lot more enrollees, especially Medicaid, coming into our program, a different mix perhaps, and changes in the marketplace is reflected by the low premiums in our exchange. So we think doing statewide recruitment makes a great deal of sense. So why are we here? Because we, of course, the legislature has given the commissioner the authority to do that. But historically, what the department has done is have regions of the state up for re-procurement on a yearly basis. So 3 years ago, we had the metro area. Last year, we put 27 counties out for Duluth area, St. Cloud and others, out for competitive bid. And traditionally, later this year, we would be re-procuring for counties in southwest Minnesota. Part of this is driven by history, the way the department has done things, but part of it is driven by a Department of Administration requirement that contracts be re-procured at least every 5 years. Some people question about whether that applies to these contracts, but we really thought it best in light of our goal of doing statewide re-procurement, part of which is required by the federal government, to come to the legislature and ask to make it clear that we do not need to re-procure in southwest Minnesota basically this year. And that is what subsection A does. The reason is, and we certainly could re-procure for southwest Minnesota later this year, but then we'd be re-procuring for them again the following year, which did not seem to make a great deal of sense to us. But more critically, what we have learned a lot of lessons from our two recent rounds of competitive bidding. I think those have really given the state a good value in our managed care contracting. We feel good about the progress we've made. But one of the things we've clearly learned that more communication, more planning going into competitive bidding is really helpful and important. We want to have time to work with the counties individually and collectively to get their input. We want to work with advocates and other stakeholders, and we want to work with the health plans to really come up with a statewide process that we all understand and that we think best serves the state. So that's why we think rather than spending the time later this year re-procuring in southwest Minnesota, we would be better spending that time and effort really setting up a very good statewide re-procurement for 2015. So that's subdivision A. And subdivision section B is really kind of what the proposals for us to consider in that procurement, the statewide procurement. These are not required. This is something the department could just put out in an RFP after, you know, engaging folks around this. But from our perspective, we think that if there is alignment around these, and Mr. Golden will go through them in more detail, that sends a strong message about what the if there's alignment between the department, the legislature, about what we should be looking for in our managed care contracting. So with that, Madam Chair, happy to take questions now or later, but I propose turning this over to our Medicaid director.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair, committee members, just for the record, Jim Golden, Medicaid Director at the Department of Human Services. I'll go quickly. I think that the Commissioner got most of the highlights in looking at lines 10 through 14. That's really just to be clear that we won't be procuring for the Southwest region this year. I think looking at lines 15 through 19, it really identifies when we'll be procuring for, so that's calendar year 16. I think the other thing that it does, one of the biggest challenges we typically have with the RFP process is just the timing, making sure that we're prompt in getting things out. This actually holds DHS's feet to the fire to say that we need to have an RFP available for respondents by January 5th. We think that will give them time to be able to respond. That's traditionally earlier than we traditionally get that out. The other sections, so if you look at lines 20 through 24, that really is putting a requirement on DHS that is responsive to the feedback that we have heard from counties. One of the biggest issues that are facing counties individually is what providers in their county area are working with the various MCOs and other respondents, county-based purchasing. How are the counties able to have a say in that? The other issue is the degree to which respondents are responsive to the concerns of the counties. You know, we often hear many of the same concerns around transportation, around dental, around mental health, behavioral health providers. This is really an opportunity for those counties to come together and help really score the various respondents in those major areas of concerns to the counties. And then finally, line 25 through 35 on this page, and then 1 through 6 on the other page, are really the specific scoring criteria. Looking at them in order, number one, this is really trying to understand with someone who is responding to our RFP, what are they doing around payment reform? To what degree are they aligning incentives with healthcare providers to really ensure that we have long-term savings? The second issue is really their integration. To what degree are they integrating their medical care, their behavioral care, and many of the county social services? You know, this is an area that we constantly are getting feedback from on the counties, and we really want to make sure we incorporate that into the scoring. There's a great deal of interest in making sure that all of our health plans have adequate quality and have high quality for our providers. This is an opportunity for us to hear what they're doing on that and to score them on that as well. The next two are really responding to the counties. The first one is letting the counties help us understand and score the providers in their area, as well as the issues that are of concern to the counties. And we've proposed to really take those issues regionally. While we think that there's a lot of similarity across the state, we do know that some of the regions of the state do have slightly different concerns, and we want to be responsive to that in the procurement process. Looking at page 187, number 6 is really how well are they doing on administrative requirements as well as administrative costs. That has been a topic of interest to the legislature for a number of years. We think that we are making great strides in that, but this is an opportunity to really score those plans that are doing best in that. We know that individuals' life circumstances change, whether they're on medical assistance, Minnesota Care, tax credits, employer insurance, and we know that people come and go throughout the year. We really want to make sure that the people who are coming into our plans or going out to other forms of coverage really have a smooth transition that is supportive of their health. and we really want to make sure to understand what any health plan that's providing coverage for our enrollees would be doing to help support that. Obviously, the next one, number eight, is really what's the cost. Obviously, cost is a component to this. We have listed it as number eight because we think that the first seven are very important and should be identified first. And then finally, number nine is just any other criteria that would be necessary as we get further guidance under federal law or which would improve the procurement as we work with stakeholders.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Golden. Are there questions from members? Oh, we've got a list. Representative Abler, then Mac.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome back, Dr. Golden. I haven't seen you all session, so it's just nice to have you here. Anyway, I'll just ask something easy about there's going to be some savings that maybe come from the here. Is that going to accrue to the general fund or the health care access fund?
Mr. Golden? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I think it really depends on, you know, which program. But I think one of the reasons that we think it's important we have to put the Minnesota Care contracts all out for bid next year. One of the reasons we want to have it all lined up, so we're doing that very early, is so that certainly if there are savings that, you know, that they can be recognized early in the year.
Yeah, thanks. And Madam
Chair. Abler?
And I just beg and ask some fiscal questions, but they haven't come to that, hasn't been to that committee, but I'll just try to stick with one, because all this policy drives the money. And the design of the Minnesota Care Plan that we did, the basic health plan, is better than platinum. And during conference, I kept asking, what are we spending that we're going to wish we wouldn't have? And the deficit in the health care access fund is extreme. And so maybe I'll just ask Dr. Golden, since he's the Medicaid director, to comment about what effect that's going to have on this. And I would stay awake at night thinking about a deficit of $300 million a year in a plan like that. And is part of that, are they going to offer some redesign ideas about how they would change the basic health plan? And so if you'd comment about that, would you please?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, if I may I answer that question? And then I'll ask Dr. Golden.
Ask your director, actually, but go ahead.
I'll make sure he has an opportunity to answer your question as well, Madam Chair, Representative Abler. But just let me say that certainly there is a gap now in the Healthcare Access Fund. There's no question about that. Part of that gap, we think, is going to be addressed by, because when CMS issued these two rules within the last 2 weeks, they actually modified two of them to address two of our most significant concerns. So we will have, we think, additional dollars there. We're trying to quantify that. That will not solve the gap. But I think our approach overall is we need to understand and get our arms around the magnitude of the problem, or maybe it's not as big a problem, before we attempt to solve it. This is not a problem in this biennial budget. We not only know that now we have additional federal dollars that we will be receiving that were not anticipated in the February forecast, we also need to get our arms around just what the Minnesota Care enrollment is going to be. Right now, that we know, while our Medicaid enrollment is exceeding expectations, our Minnesota Care enrollment is extensively below what's in the forecast, which obviously drives how much of a gap there is in the health care access fund. So that's why we think it's important to kind of understand really the scope of the challenge that we need to solve before solving it. But certainly one of the reasons we want to do an early procurement in our Minnesota Care program and statewide, as well as our other programs, is to quickly assess whether there are additional dollars and better value which we can go to address any gaps that remain. But
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I guess what I would say is last year the legislature passed the requirements for Minnesota Care as it relates to eligibility, benefits, premiums, and cost sharing. There is absolutely nothing in this language that would change any of those decisions that the legislature made last year. So what this procurement is really doing is looking for qualified health plans that would be able to meet the requirements that are in statute. With all of our procurements, one of the clauses that we put in there is that if any of those factors change, we will adjust the procurement as part of that, as part of the contracting and the negotiation process with the health plans. That is something that frequently happens as we do procurements and the legislature meets and makes decisions.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Abler.
And I'll shift to another angle, but I, you know, the it's a problem, and I'm just concerned, and it's good the members of this committee understand that policy matters drive money, and I was helped to be responsible to repeal the provider tax, which was deemed to be unnecessary if we could have been a bit more, I thought, prudent with the choices we were making. But just one more thing about the county-based purchasing. There's a lot of really good ones of those, and is every county going to have a chance to rebid, and is like Blue Cross and Medica and Health Partners going to have a chance to re-enter every possible county and rebid? Where they're not there now, or where a county is doing good work, and can you comment about that, please?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, you know, I think it's helpful to look at both of the programs separately, because I think there's a little bit of difference between those. So with regard to Minnesota Care, federal regulations do require that we have in wherever possible, multiple health plans available for enrollees to choose. Enrollee choice is one of the key components as it relates to Minnesota Care. In our current Minnesota Care program, I believe in almost every county, if not every county, we currently have multiple options, including the county-based purchasers where they are interested in providing Minnesota Care benefits. With regard to medical assistance, first of all, I think that the county-based purchasing would score very well on these criteria based on this, but I would also say it is not our intent to fundamentally change the relationship, and this doesn't change any of the other statutory provisions as it relates to county-based purchasing and their ability in their counties to provide medical assistance.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I appreciate letting me ask the questions, and I'm happy with those answers. David. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Abler actually answered one of them, or got one of the answers for the county-based purchasing part. I just have a couple of questions in terms of Commissioner Justin. I know you said that a lot of this is just what you can be looking for through the procurement process and the RFP, but I'm trying to understand the mechanics of some of it. For instance, on 186.2 line 186.27, it talks about one of the factors should be the degree to which a respondent's health care provider network is contracted through total cost of care contracts. And I guess I'm just looking for clarification. Is that assuming at 100% capitation? I'm curious how that works so that it's fair for PMAP and Medicaid. I'm just wondering what assumption is being made when we're looking at total cost of care contracts.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack. This is pretty broad language, so obviously this would be some of the language we'd be working with people to make clear, you know, as we move into an RFP. But in general, the thought here is to really kind of further what the direction we're trying to take it as a state to have to agreements with provider organizations to provide services for a defined population, and then to agree with the state to meet the quality measures for those populations, but also to, you know, look at what the projected costs would be for that population. And if they come in under those costs, there can be gain sharing and ultimately kind of risk sharing. These are arrangements that we have with, I think it is 8-9 provider organizations all across our state today. We'd like to encourage more providers to do this. We think it's, but we have those agreements with providers called our kind of IHPs, Integrated Health Partnerships. We used to call them HCBS, but they're basically Medicaid ACOs. But our agreements with the providers then, if they end up saving money through this, you know, apply whether their enrollees are in our fee-for-service or in our managed care programs. But what we're trying to do with this is because we do think this is a way to improve population health and get better value for the dollars we spend. So we want to evaluate the provider networks as, you know, and how many providers are in that sort of arrangement, either with the state or perhaps just with the health plan. Because a number of health plans, it really varies, have very similar arrangements with their providers. But we really are trying to, we see this as a way of getting better value. It's one of our goals of our you know, SIM project. So that's the sort of, in general, thing we would be evaluating. We did evaluate in our last contracting, in our last competitive bid, health plans on some of their health reform efforts. Here we're just trying to be more specific about what those efforts should look like.
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you for that. And I guess kind of along the same lines, just the line below that, it continues on. And I just ask because I know that this isn't necessarily mandating, but, you know, words do matter, and especially we're putting this in statute. So I'm just trying to understand on line 186.30, it talks about the degree to which a respondent has demonstrated mechanisms and processes to achieve integration of medical care, behavioral health care, and county social services. And I guess I'm just trying to wonder, how is that measured? How is that done when providers and plans can't necessarily share clinical appropriate data that actually is telling them if they are coordinating care and managing care to the best of their abilities? I'm just wondering, how does that work? Is that being done right now? Is that not being done? And that's why it's here? And if it's not being done, how can it be done moving forward? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I'll answer this, and I'm sure Dr. Golden will add things if he thinks I've missed something. But I think that, Madam Chair, Representative Mack, this is being done in some parts of their state. You're absolutely right that the ability to share information on individuals, someone who's being served by both our social service system, maybe in our mental health system, in our acute care system, is sometimes an impediment to being able to do that as effectively as we would like. You know, however, there are certainly parts, I can think of several parts of our state where that is being done. If you think of some of the work of the Beacon Project in southeastern Minnesota, if you think of what they're doing at Hennepin Health with some of our, you know, Medicaid enrollees that are kind of single adults and some of our poorest, you know, people with chronic illnesses. And there are a number of other examples, as Dr. Golden was saying, in our number of county-based purchasers really do an excellent job of this. What we really want to do is kind of use those as role models and encourage more of that across our state.
Okay. And Madam Chair, one final thing. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm just trying to get, a handle on how the mechanics of that work, so I appreciate that. And so I guess in my last comment is just following up on what Representative Abler said. I was going to ask about the basic health plan and how that interacts with some of this stuff. And, you know, just a concern that I know many of us share around the table is the state of the healthcare access fund. But I do hope the department, you know, if there's ways to reevaluate the basic health plan and what that looks like going forward and what the state's signing on for, while some might, you know, breathe a sigh of relief at the thought of more federal dollars coming to help bridge the gap, that would give me an ulcer or a stomachache knowing we're, you know, that federal dollars is our best hope in terms of filling that gap, because that's a finite pool and has several problems of its own. And so I guess, you know, for me, that's a scary situation if our best hope there is we're hoping more federal dollars are coming down, because I think we're going to need better and more creative solutions on an ongoing basis to fix the structural problems we have in some of that. And I think the basic health plan is going to be a major factor in that piece. And so hope we can continue that conversation, work together on how we can better address that beyond relying on the federal government for it.
All right. Commissioner, did you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I do agree this needs to be part of an ongoing conversation, which I look forward to.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a big deal, and it will affect everybody who's served under these programs. And I appreciate you've put together some criteria here. I noted on item 4 you want each county's input regarding to the net adequacy of the respondent's network. And network isn't adequacy varies by the state or sometimes the specialty, but it's certainly an issue in some areas versus others. And I appreciate the fact that you want the county's input because they'll have on-the-ground knowledge on that. But I didn't see that same comment on item 2, the degree to which they have demonstrated processes to integrate behavioral health care and county social services. And I would hope that we would also seek each county's input on that, because they really will understand whether they've reached out and been rebuffed or, you know, and I think that would be a valuable piece of information in evaluating the responses.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I must say, as I looked at kind of the B2, organized counties as regional groups and get insights about each respondent's ability. I mean, I see that as part of that, but I understand what you are saying, and certainly that is part of what, you know, we normally do, getting county input, and that would be important.
Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I'll actually say, well, I think that you need each county's individual response on the integration because they each do approach behavioral health and social services differently. So under Roman numeral 2, on line 186.29, that's where I was suggesting that we add it on. On 186.22, which is organizing counties into regional groups, I think you should consult with, and I welcome the input of Metro Counties and others, as to whether or not that's a comfortable approach. And long before I was elected, I was involved in the first re-procurement of these contracts in 20-plus years. And we were forced to do it as a region in the metro area, and we found that there were really big differences between the experiences in certain counties versus others. The issues that were being raised by Hennepin were not necessarily the ones that Scott County wanted it addressed at all, and to have to come to a consensus on what are your concerns really meant that you were not getting the real understanding of what was going on. And since half the state's population is in the metro area, 25% just in one county in terms of enrollment, it really feels to me that we need to look at having single county or smaller groupings potentially, and I would hope that you would engage with the larger counties about that. That may also be true with regional centers in greater Minnesota. It may be that there's unique issues in Olmsted County that aren't the same as the surrounding rural counties. And it's sometimes hard when you put disparate sort of issues together to really get a true picture of who's best responding to which populations.
Okay.
And the other thing is I would ask that you add something on special populations because those are certainly clustered in certain parts of the state. And just as we don't evaluate schools just on how they do on every school child, we also look at subpopulations we should hear as well.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And members, we have two more testifiers on this topic. And then we have, as you know, 10 minutes left in our hearing today. If we can hear from our other two testifiers, I'm going to then ask if there's public testimony. But if we don't finish, we'll come back this evening. But I think there's a possibility that if we can be efficient with our time, we may not have to. So thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Golden. Please stick around, and we will may need you back. But Jay McLaren and Joel Euland, please. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I am the Assistant Director for Legislative Affairs at UCARE. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, along with Jay McLaren here from Medica. I will begin first. Obviously, from our perspective, we're still getting our arms wrapped around this language. As the first time that we saw it was yesterday, we're still getting input. In fact, my email is still buzzing this afternoon on input on this. So certainly we will ask for some additional opportunities to continue to look at this language if we need amendments. That we would be able to address that as well. I think that we certainly understand, and it was very helpful to have the presentation just ahead of us because that answered a number of the questions that we had been raising about this proposal. Certainly as it relates to the basic health program, we recognize that this has been an area of great uncertainty for the past year or two. We know that the department has done a great deal of work in working with the federal government to try to clarify a number of things. And certainly, you know, as we look forward to what the next steps are, I can understand where this type of procurement process may come along. I think one of the things that we are going to be wanting to understand is just how this fits in also with the competitive bidding process that already exists. The commissioner did allude to that, and so I think that's just another area that the industry is just going to want to make sure that we have our arms wrapped around as to how that relates to that. As to the sections that relate to the county input, I think that this is something that we feel would be very valuable as well. We work with our counties quite frequently and sometimes on a daily basis on different issues with our members. And so certainly if there are areas of concern that the counties are bringing as it relates to the procurement process, we think that that's probably a good idea that the department has a mechanism for accepting that. I think the only suggestion that we would have at this point is that we would also want, as an industry, want to have an ability to react to what is being brought as concerns. There are situations that we've run into, UCARE has run into, where sometimes it may be just a miscommunication communication, or that somebody is not aware of a set of providers that we may have in our network or have out-of-date information. So as the department looks at that part of their procurement process and is getting that kind of input, we would just ask that there also be an opportunity to provide additional feedback to make sure that the record is clear about that. I think one final point that I would make is that as it relates to the capitation, that was certainly one of the questions that was brought up earlier. I think that, you know, as we look at that, that's one of the areas of concern that we have as well as to what are the measurements that are going to be out there to manage risk for these entities that are going to be seeking procurement. And so, you know, these are questions that we'll want to have some further discussion with the author and with the department as well. At this point, I'll hand it over to Jay.
Okay, and we do have one question, and Representative Albright, do you want to ask it now, or should we let the other testifier finish first and ask? You'll wait? Okay. All right, Mr. McLaren.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica, and I'm also, as Joel was, testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I appreciate the opportunity to give you some thoughts and feedback. And I have to echo Mr. Euland's comments that it was helpful to get some feedback and background from the Commissioner and Dr. Golden ahead of us so that we can even answer some questions that we had before we came to the testimony table. So thank you for that. I just have three items that I wanted to bring up, Madam Chair and members. The first two have to do with the scoring criteria that starts on line 186.25. And my first comment basically is that the list appears to be appropriate for things that you would want to look at when you're doing a statewide procurement, some things that you would want to evaluate and who is applying to serve these people on public health care programs. So on our first look of it, it appears to be appropriate. I have a couple questions. So first, just on the language or some recommendations, the language in that first item that talks about looking at and evaluating the respondents' network and the extent to which they use total cost of care arrangements or shared savings arrangements or other things like that, it talks about how those are things that may be designed to generate long-term savings. That were designed, we would have some advice on. So while we wouldn't want to, while the concept seems appropriate and we wouldn't want to discourage innovation, there is an ability perhaps to go even further in that, on that, to have the respondents have some proven results, proven long-term results in those total cost of care or shared savings arrangements that they have within their network that may be able to be taken into account in the scoring of that respondent. So that's the first area of feedback. And the second area is perhaps if there's some innovation going on in this space where it's designed to or attempting to reduce costs, that perhaps we can add some language in there that talks about reduce cost and or improve patient care so that at least one of the two things would be achieved as they are trying to innovate in that space. So those are a couple of the recommendations that we have in that. On the evaluation criteria as a whole, one of the things that feedback that we would have for the department moving forward, and we can talk to them about this, is making sure that whatever evaluation criteria they have is released in that RFP right away, and that not just the criteria, but also the methodology and weight of the scoring be made transparent and open to all applicants on the front end of the process. So we will continue to talk to the author and to the department about that issue. So that's on some of the scoring pieces. The other thing I wanted to talk about was, quite frankly, something that Representative Abler brought up earlier, which had to do with what you consider to be statewide. So I think his questions basically answer some of the questions that we had on what does statewide mean, particularly when you're looking at carving up some of the counties to go together. Are there going to be multiple offerings in those, or is there going to be a request that some of the respondents be able to serve the state as a whole? So there may be some remaining questions in there that we can work with the department to clarify, but we look forward to discussing these with them and appreciate your time, Madam Chair, and the committee for allowing us to share questions and thoughts.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be either for Mr. McLaren or Mr. Euland. I'm not sure which one might want to address, but you know, in the insurance field, there is a measure of risk associated with everything that you do, and you attribute a cost to it. And given that we're embarking on 2 weeks from the deadline, I'm just wondering how you anticipate addressing that risk from a cost perspective as we impart new adjustments to the program and what you're going to do to adjust that, because you have to stay in business in order to provide the care that people are subscribing to now. So we have far-reaching as well as short-term implications to this piece of legislation. I'm just wondering if you could speak to how you as an organization or organizations are going to address that going forward.
Well,
Mr. Yulin.
Mr. Or Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I would say that the one of the things that my CEO constantly says is that being a CEO in a health plan is not for the faint of heart, especially when you're focused in state public programs. I think that one of the things that we often are dealing with is constant fluctuations in the marketplace, and certainly we have seen a great deal of that over the past couple of years, and just even as the commissioner and Medicaid director referred to, there has been some substantial changes even from forecast related to Minnesota Care. I think from our perspective, these are the constant adjustments that we are making, you know, as we look at this, and so that we are kind of looking at that as we're packaging, you know, what would be our proposals. At the same time, I think one of the things that needs to be considered, though, is that we do know that there are other payment arrangements that are being sought under this type of proposal. And I think what we want to make sure of is that there's an even playing field for this, so that, you know, as a HMO, there are quite a number of requirements that we currently have, and we want to make sure that anybody who is a respondent for that has to have some level of the same type of scrutiny that we currently have as an industry.
And Representative Albright, I just would remind you, of course, as you know, that this is a whole lot of public money being spent for our patients who are on our public programs. And just to the comment about how hard it is to manage all this, I think that they are paid very well for doing that work.
And Madam Chair, I certainly appreciate those sentiments, and I think that's exactly to the point of why I raise a concern, because we are setting policy that is directive of a huge amount of money that is being relied upon by a larger and larger constituency base of our citizens in the state. And so, you know, we're setting precedent, which is a policy directive, and so taking our fiduciary responsibility, to use that term quite literally, is, I think, incumbent upon us to ask the hard questions. So that's why I'm praising it. I wonder if Mr. McLaren would have any op-ed or comments in light of what Mr. Yulin said, Madam Chair.
So, Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Albright, I think Mr. Yulin stated it very well, in that this is our business and one of our responsibilities is to manage that risk. I think one of the benefits of some of the language that's in the bill is that it gives us some lead time to work with the department on basically how this program is going to change over time and be able to work with them and the other stakeholders to understand at least the new level of risk on top of, to your point, Representative Albright, the new type of populations that we're taking on. So at least when those two things are coming at you, at least we can address the issue that we have in front of us and work on the risk that we're taking on today while having plenty of lead time in the programmatic changes that may be coming in a couple of years.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. So is there anyone in the audience that is here to testify for or against parts of this bill? All right. I'm not seeing anybody here. So with that, members, I think we have completed the public testimony on the bill. So our next meeting will be Friday morning, 9 o'clock. So with that, unless there's any other business before the committee. Members, thank you. If you would put your bill in your folder, that would be very helpful. It would save a few trees and a few bucks for the House of Representatives. I don't think the page will throw it away. So put it in there, and thank you very much, and we are adjourned.